we talk about the artist mindset. And the artist mindset is a belief that it can be done. It's not like a hope that can be done or a dream that it can be done. It's just, you know you can do it. Do you really want to do it?
We are going to record this entire thing because this is the beginning of the Courageous Podcast. And Van Nystad, let's keep everybody honest here. We just logged on 3.2 seconds ago, right?
Yes.
But you're my friend.
Mm.
And I think I'm your friend.
You are indeed.
And trust matters. And these are two people that truly trust each other, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so in a Van Nystad sort of way, I decided to do a Van Nystad. You want to know what a Van Nystad is?
I'd love to know.
One of my favorite skills that you have, because you're probably my most curious friend, is to look at a situation, question it so deeply that you cannot help but crack it open and interrogate it to just make sure it truly is the truth. That is a Van Nystad. So I'm not even giving you the chance to respond yet.
I'm glad that's how it comes across.
No, this is me, not you.
Yeah.
But I wrote down the definition of friend.
Okay.
All right. Now, this is just one dictionary's version.
All right.
But one dictionary says friend is a person whom one knows and with whom one has a bond, a mutual affection. And when I read that, I'm like, yeah, that's how I feel about you. I love your work. I love your heart. We're like 1 minute in on this, and I know that your work is pure. And so that, I like that definition. What's your take?
My definition is a friend is someone whose hands you can place your life with confidence.
We like that. We might have to call Webster and have them change their definition.
Yeah, theirs is a little milk toast. I mean, come on.
All right. So how many friends do you have? That you really trust?
I might think. Well, isn't there, there's a name for it. There's that like 150 number.
Ooh,
it's probably that. It's probably 150, like ride or die. I mean, that sounds really, really high, but I'm old.
That's
so
true.
So, you know, there are within that 150, there are people that maybe I haven't talked to in 10 years, you know? And I'm not a very good friend. Like, I'm not very good at relationships. I'm a good father, but I'm not a good husband. I'm okay. You know, I'm not a very good friend. I'm a terrible son. I'm a pretty bad brother.
Good uncle?
No. No. I'm like a C- uncle, C+, C, depending on which of my nieces or nephew you ask. But I don't know. I have an incredible like amount of admiration and respect for my friend. And when I hear people get like screwed over or have horrible surprises that a friend pulls on them, or they talk about a friend and they've done some sinister, horrible thing, I know none of my friends are in that category. None of my friends would do those such of things. Another way to say that is that I think that my friends, the 150, you know what? It's 60. I think it's 60 because I have this invite list and I'm like, those are the people. Although there's some people on that list that aren't necessarily like, they're, you know, it's more professional stuff.
Mm.
But, I think my friends, yourself included, are of high moral fortitude and very strong character, like virtuous.
But when you kind of grade the give yourself a C- on the other shit, is it because I mean, you're my one friend. Okay. What a surprise. The storyteller is going to tell another storyteller a story. All right. So
you're good.
All right, here we go. So my wedding was the perfect example of the only way I could have possibly invited you to my wedding. So everybody else who are also friends and also like loved ones got a normal formal invitation. And my wife, who's trying to plan a wedding at the time, was just Randy. That's how you would normally do such a thing. If I would have sent you a normal, formal invitation, guess who's not coming to my wedding? Van Neistat. So what does it have to be? It's a text. Your invitation was a text. And it was, hey, no obligations. Here's the deal. We're going to get married in Cabo. You got 6 months to get there. Here's the date. And of course, your response was,
see you there, I hope.
Well, see you there, I hope. It was see you there with an asterisk.
Oh, cool.
No, it was cool because you were like, oh man, I always wanted to do this ride. Right? What was the ride?
It was my second attempt of an off-road motorcycle ride from Los Angeles to Cabo San Lucas, and it was a success.
And then what was it called? The Baja?
Well, we ended up doing the very big portions of the Baja 1000 race course.
Okay. So for those of you who are paying attention to this, you heard him say we. Okay, he said, we ended up. Now, first of all, I'm not part of that we because I'm going to get married in Cabo. Now, second, you might not have heard me say I sent a text to 4 or 5 people. I sent a text to Van saying, here's the date. Can you get down there? And in Van, as only Van Neistat could do, he's like, it won't just be me. Is it cool if I bring a couple buddies to your wedding? Okay, now, that's our friendship. Of course. It's not even like remotely a question. If that's what it's going to take to get Van Neistat to Cabo, I'm telling you, just like it is. True story. Yes. And you would think, for those of you who are listening, your wife was cool with that. And when you know Van, I'm like, of course. That's what the room will be ready for you. If you can make it.
God, you treated us so well. It was beautiful.
If you can get there. Nothing would make me happier. And you guys got there the night before. Can you explain, like,
okay. So it was Yaniv Shulman, myself, and a man named John, and I think his last name is Teal. Now, this is a person I consider my friend. He's literally a ride or die because we were in life-threatening, you know, 5 day and then 5 days back journey. But I've only really known him on that occasion and I haven't really talked to him. I see his sister occasionally at parties and I'm pretty sure his last name is Teal. And so it was the three of us. He was Neve's friend and we rode BMW, like big BMWs down the Baja Peninsula. And when we got to Cabo, like that day, I'm pretty sure I had my only flat tire of the trip that day. But by the end of the trip, we had changed a dozen flat tires. And this is not you go to a garage and get your tire changed. This is with your bare hands in the desert with tools prying the things off. So, I mean, John probably had a couple, 2 or 3 flats that day. And, I mean, I remember that day. And we got there. And, you know, when you ride your motorcycle there, Cabo gradually comes to you. So we had done the entire Baja Peninsula, zigzagged West Coast, East Coast, because that's how the roads and off-roads go over mountain ranges. And we had gotten there and we just like dissolved into this Cabo San Lucas and we pull up. It's this luxurious. It was like the first luxury of the trip, this luxurious hotel with like fancy cars and stuff. We pull up, our motorcycles are laden with all of our gear, camping gear, tools, so forth. And we are covered, like Hollywood style, covered in dust. And we got out, we're like, holy shit, we don't fit in here. And when we walked down, you know, we took off our backpacks and all our shit, and we just had like riding, you know, adventure gear and big boots on. And we walked down, and like everyone's just like, and everyone just looked at us. And we were treated so well. Everyone was so nice to us, including you and Randy. And I think you like gave us your room the night before your wedding.
You can't, you know, obviously I can't sleep with I can't be in our room that right. night. So I had a second room, and by the way, you guys look like you were like in a Mad Max movie. That's what it looked like when you showed up. Like you had hair everywhere, fur, you know, the hair you had was up, dust everywhere. And we were probably so nice because I think it was around 8 or 9 PM and we had just come back from the rehearsal dinner and everyone was probably pretty, you know, loose. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
We were loose. But the other thing I remember for a fact was Neve's movie had just come out. Catfish had just come out. So, so half of the people at the wedding had seen it and were like, oh my God, Catfish was amazing. And like, I don't know Neve at the time. I'm like, Van's.
Is this the first time you'd met him?
First time we met. I'm like, Van's bringing some buddies down. This is so Van-esque. No problem. And Randy's like, it's Van. It's fine. And then, so Neve shows up, and one of my buddies is probably the biggest contrarian. We used to call him Hater, because if he wasn't hating on you, he actually hated you. This was his nickname. He was like, that's Neve from Catfish. That's Catfish. And he's like, he couldn't believe that Neve was there. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I really don't know what you're talking about. Seems like a nice guy. By the way, and you made a whole video on this. Like, it was very Van, a very special, you made like a 5-minute video for us. And you, this is so you, by the way, that in your mind, which probably is already a 3-act play, thinking through the way stories are told, even in all that dirty and all that messy, there were certain clothes you had stored in like a little bag.
Oh yeah, no, it was in a box. It was in a box so it wouldn't get wrinkled. Yeah, it was on. Yeah, that's right.
That you had taken down. You had taken down.
I shaved my beard and got a haircut the day of your wedding, like in town at a real.
It was amazing.
And my barber was trans. It was so cool. I mean, it was so photogenic and beautiful, and yeah.
And then Neve is an exceptional photographer, which nobody knows. They just think he's like the Catfish guy or the MTV guy or now he's a good dancer. Annoyingly
talented. He ran a sub-3 marathon. Oh, he ran a marathon in under 3 hours. Yeah, he's annoying and he's a great dancer and he's tall. He has a great smile. He's annoyingly talented. Yes.
He had this black and white camera that he brought. Mm. He's like, do you mind if I shoot your wedding? Go have at it. So half the people that were there at the wedding, and all I really wanted was, because I had my whole East Coast life and my West Coast life. Yeah. I'm like, get down there. And all I wanted was by the time the wedding showed up is that East Coast people were using West Coast nicknames and West Coast people were using East Coast nicknames. And that's what happened. But half the party who was there knew because they had met you guys the night before. And then half the party was like my parents' age. And they're like, did you guys hire the party starters?
These clowns.
Did you guys hire the party starters? Because like you and John and Neve were the first ones on the dance floor, and who knows whatever. I don't know what anybody was on. Whatever. You guys were having a blast.
Before I got sober. Yeah. We were drunk as fuck. Yeah.
So anyway, you will always have a special place in my heart. You're as my friend. And I imagine that for the rest of our lives, there will be opportunities for experiences like that, that will be a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. That you'll be like, I need you here. Or I'll be like, come with us here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all good. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you're leaving out a part of the story. So I had done this twice. So I did a practice run where I only made it about 200 miles down the Baja Peninsula. And that was 2009. Your wedding was in 2011. And when I went down the first time, I met you and stayed at your house the night before crossing the border in Mexico. I stayed at your house in San Diego, or your apartment. And you filmed me in the, and you were filming the, and you filmed me crossing the border. And I, that footage is, it's on my YouTube channel. That adventure is on my YouTube channel.
And but you that's lied not to me. One.
Why? And what
you,
did I say?
And you lied to me.
I doubt that.
Oh, you absolutely did. But all right. So here's what happened. And you can watch us out. What's your, let's do the plug now, just so I can get it out of the way the right way. What's so YouTube channel?
Channel, it's my name, Van Nystat. But if you search on YouTube, The Spirited Man, that you'll find my channel.
All right, that's, cool. That's I'm wearing
a shirt.
I'm wearing a Spirited Man sweatshirt that I love. I'm still in pandemic gear, clearly. Like, anyway. All right. So yeah, you come down. And you're
what
like,
was
you're
the going, lie? I don't believe this.
I'm getting to it. Yeah. So basically, okay. And you got to, we have to remember Matthew Ellison, Matthew Nervous Purvis Ellison, because Matt was my buddy who moved to California. He drove my car so I could record you going over the border.
Yeah.
And sort of naively, this is even like, I mean, way before the border, like at this time, there was nobody said wall and border together. Like this is a long time ago. Mm. So I'm in the passenger seat of my car while Matt Ellison is driving my car. And I'm just, you know, it's a shiny morning and I'm just recording away. And we finally get to that lane where I can't follow you across anymore. Mm. I got to get in the left lane to make a U-turn to stay in America. So like my head's out the window.
Right.
And I'm holding your camera. And of course I got a tutorial from Van on how to record his camera. So I didn't blow the footage. And this is again, very you multiple cameras at play. He's got one on his bike, probably one packed away. He's like, this is the sacrificial camera that I can record on and send back to him for hopes of just getting a couple good shots for some episode. So I shoot away. And as I start turning U-turn, Border Patrol's like, pull over, pull over, pull over, pull over. I mean, I'm obviously pulling over. Stop recording the camera. Stop recording. I'm like, so I try to pretend to stop recording. I'm like, this would be great for the footage.
Yeah.
I keep recording. Right. Long time ago. And then I'm like, I don't know how to stop it. It's my friend's camera. I'm sorry. Give me the camera. Oh, I know how to stop it. I've stopped it.
Yeah.
Show me you stopped it. You know, I'm like, oh, I can't pull the tape out. I don't know how to do that. It's not my camera. Okay, just get out of here. So somehow Maddie and I get out of there with the camera. Here's the lie. I send the camera back to you.
Yeah.
And you tell me it never made it. And for years, you didn't do anything with the story.
Well, maybe it hadn't made it at the time you asked me.
Okay. This is an asterisk. I didn't intentionally.
I'm not a lie. I don't lie to people.
All right. All right. What I believed is that you were like, oh, this isn't going to be, I'm going to hold this.
Maybe you sent it to New York and I was in LA or vice versa.
Oh, maybe that's possible.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, you didn't do anything with the footage for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then 12 years. So what happened? Did you just get curious and like open up all your shit and start making stuff again?
I was going on an adventure with my son and I had been posting YouTube videos twice a week. My brother, who's like a big YouTuber, he said it's really important to be consistent for the algorithm. And so I needed to be able to have a whole bunch of videos pre-made before I went to Utah for the week with my boy. And so I had all this footage shot. I had that whole adventure shot and I started watching the footage and it like played. It was like, oh, this is good. I can just edit this without having to shoot or write anything new and this will play out. And that's what it did. It was like 6 or 7 parts, you know, maybe 10 minutes each. So it was like a feature, almost like a feature film. It was good though. It was fun, you know, like a sort of vlog or whatever you would call that. It was really interesting, I think.
So what do you call yourself? Are you a filmmaker? Are you a storyteller? Are you an artist? What do you say?
The general term that's like now that I like, do you know who Jack Conti is? He started Patreon. The general term that he's popularized is a creator. And that's basically, they used to say influencer or YouTuber, but it's basically like an artist entrepreneurial kind of name, but not really. I mean, artist, I'm paranoid of that word because there's this guy named Bobby Newirth who would tour around with, he was like Bob Dylan's confidant when Bob Dylan was just starting out and blowing up. And he's in the No Direction Home documentary that Scorsese made about Bob Dylan maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Bobby Newirth said, artist is a honor that is earned. Referring to yourself as an artist is like referring to yourself as a genius. So I, you know,
I like that.
When I'm talking to somebody, I'm trying to like contextualize blah, blah, blah. I'll use that word, but I try to stay away from it. And I think that, yeah, I think the creator, but you know, like a YouTuber, that's the lowest level. That's like the most vernacular.
Word doesn't do you
for,
justice.
For what I do.
I don't think it, like, I definitely don't like influencer because it, there's too many layers and negative connotations with that word. Like, I'm like an influencer or you have influence. And I'm, that's a whole episode in itself, right?
Mm.
I like creator because I feel the very essence for why you're creating is more important than the other stuff. And
what do you mean? What's the other stuff?
Well, I don't know. I think for a long time of all the people that I know, you're very pure. Like you want to tell a good story. You want to stay true to the integrity of the story versus just doing something to make money. Now maybe that's changed.
I'll endorse anything. You got crack you're trying to sell? Yeah, let's put it on the channel. We'll talk.
Throw it on the channel already. Well, now, I mean, you're not just a creator, you're a creative business person and you make cool shit. But let's go back to HBO for a minute. Do you like talking about the HBO days or not really?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time ago. It's like a decade ago. We started shooting in 2007, and then we finished in 2009, and it didn't go on the air until 2010. So I have lots of footage that I've been through. Today I went through footage. I found, miraculously, I needed a shot of a Toyota Land Cruiser in a foreign country, and I miraculously had the perfect shot of a 70 series Land Cruiser that I was in a Land Rover in the Serengeti, and we're like driving down a dirt road. There's a like thatched hut, and parked in front of it is the Land Cruiser, and just pulled up and it's like framed perfectly. We stop, Casey jumps out and like walks to, it was like, and I found it. I spent a lot of time archiving my footage, putting it all in chronological order and in hard drive so that it's super accessible. It's plugged in right now. The hard drive is on my desktop right now. It took me like 5 minutes to. So a lot of the HBO like footage is in my mind, but the actual memory of it is a little vague. But sure, I don't mind talking about it.
I feel like for you and Casey, it really like catapulted your creative careers. Like obviously you've done so much more, and someone had to green light the show before the show went. But I think you called them professional homemade videos. Is that what it was?
What we had a great term for it, and it was in the beginning. It was in the intro of each episode. We shot a unique intro for every episode, which I highly don't recommend, but it's a handmade home movie video show or something.
That's
like that.
That's what it was. It was handmade, homemade. It was like something, it was beautiful. So like that's what, I mean, we had friends of friends who introduced us, and our other ritual that you and I had was I would probably get to the city once a quarter, and it didn't matter what time it was. You would receive a text from me, and the deal was you were going to meet me at the Soho Grand.
For burgers.
For a burger. And I would pick up the burger with ketchup, I think.
You pick up everything.
Right?
So generous. Yeah.
But then afterwards, we would go back to your studio, in Soho, and you would like that was the playtime. Like we'd start out, we'd catch up and it, other people might be there and it was like iceberg stuff. Cool. I like to bring people together and music was going at Soho Grand when that was a cool thing. Mm. And you'd your burger would be waiting for you and you get a meal in you. And then you and I would head back and like we could, I felt like it was like an awesome place to just experiment. You could test shit and show stuff to me. And you allowed me to open my big mouth and be like, did you think about it this way? I ever thought about it that way? And it was playtime, man. And that studio, and actually, Neve was next door.
He's across the street. I mean, that I talk about this, but there's Henry Joost, who's Ariel Schulman's directing partner, creative partner, business partner, and the two of them made the original Catfish documentary, and then they're the executive producers of the Catfish television show that we all know Neve from. But they're like big Hollywood directors. They just did a film, or during the pandemic, a film of theirs with Jamie Foxx called, I think it's called The Power Project, that came out. I mean, they've done a bunch. They worked with huge movie stars. Anyway, Henry Joost coined the phrase the Diane Fink School, and Diane Fink was who we all paid our rent to. She owned the two buildings that, okay, Neve Schulman, Ariel Schulman, Henry Joost, they were across the street, that's Supermarché. And then in our building, in Casey and my building, you had Josh and Benny Safdie, who wrote and directed Uncut Gems. You had Alex Kalman, who is a museum artist who's had shows at, you know, at MoMA and at the Metropolitan Museum. You had Lena Dunham, had a space who she did Girls. I won't even get to them all. And Greta Gerwig was part of our gang. She was like roommates of our studio manager. I like spent the night, she was away running a marathon somewhere, and I like spent the night in her room for some reason. I don't remember why. She had tons of books. But yeah, that was the Diane Fink School. It was unbelievable time. We were all starting from scratch. None of us had our break yet. And we all kind of broke around the same, within the same like 2 or 3 years, like Josh and Ben Safdie. They helped. We hired them to help us build our studio in our tiny little 400 square foot studio. And then like within 12 months, we all flew to Cannes because their feature film got into the director's fortnight at the Cannes Film Festival. And we were all in it because he needed faces. And a lot of us helped make it. And it was, and he brought us up on stage very generously, and it was, and then the next year, the next film went to Cannes of theirs, but that was an extremely special time. And for Ariel Schulman and Henry Joost had like a 10-year anniversary a ways back. And it was amazing that we all had like a party in Chinatown, but I get really nostalgic. It's hard to watch footage from those days because it was just like so fun. It was really, 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 really hard, but also really fun. And to have that network of people is fucking unbelievable.
Do you feel like back then when you're so like, you know, you're kind of, I mean, let's call it what it is. You're starting out, you think you have something, but you don't know. You're kind of drowning. You're kind of not. They're all doing the same. They're all drowning. They're kind of not until they're going to Cannes, right? But like, when you have that much creativity or talent around you, but you have your own fears on like, how do I do this and get, and like, I just want to do this. Can I get paid to do this? Mm. Is it?
It's just hand to mouth. It's hand to mouth. It's really, really hard to have the big picture, because for us the big picture thing just came from an outside source, came from this man Tom Scott, and he loved our work and he said, look, I will stake horse you guys and put together something and we'll sell it. And it worked, and I don't know, you probably couldn't do it today. But I can't emphasize that enough. It's so just being in the trenches. It's like this far in front of you. I think if you were to talk to my brother, he would have a different strategy. He's also much more successful than me. So, and he was, you know, he grew up a lot faster than me because he had his first kid when he was 17 years old. He's a millionaire at 30, though. So,
do you guys ever work together anymore? Or like, what, why, like, why haven't you?
Oh, I call him all the time. I force him to give me hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of advice. And he's always like kicking projects and people. And if I ever need to get in touch with somebody, I'm like, I just did this show, this YouTube show called Colin and Samir. And these guys, they're basically the meet the press of YouTube, and that like, they know everything. They've had all of the biggest YouTube people on their show, and they're experts and they're fantastic. They're like the source. They're like 2020 or Dateline or something, super smart guys. And they're YouTubers too, because this thing comes out on YouTube. And, they were just up here. I lost my train of thought.
I was asking if you ever, you and Casey have worked on anything.
Oh, no, but I was listening to their podcast and they mentioned my brother in every one of their, on every one of their shows. So I was like, do you know these guys? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, can you put me in touch? And then like, you know, a month later that I'm on their show. I mean, it hasn't come out yet, but yeah. Nah, he doesn't work with anybody really. He's not someone you, I mean, I would hate to work with me. I hate working with myself. And, he doesn't really work with anyone. He doesn't. I mean, he's his own thing and I'm my own thing, but I talk, and every time I get in I have a big question or something, he's very generous with, you know, his advice and so forth.
Well, I want to know why you hate working with yourself, and I can, as you're marinating on that,
yeah.
I can tell you what I love. Can I share a quick story and then we can come back to that?
Yes.
Okay. So I think we're living in a time where we're all overwhelmed and there's too much and we're stressed and we're freaked. And like, there's a billion channels. Mm. There's too much, you know? And who am I? This is like, I clearly sound like an old curmudgeon. The good old days when there was like three channels and that was it and there was space. But what I always love about your work, and it's been consistent since you and Casey were doing your thing and now, you know, the Spirit of Man stuff is, and this is hard to do for me because I still see myself somewhat in the storytelling business. So I'm constantly like looking at the story, but you've helped me escape and breathe. And your stories are so good at just breathing and like getting lost in the moment and letting things, having the discipline to escape people from what runs their life, which is time, and feeling time starved and quick and go like this and you've lost your neck. And every single time I watch your stuff, I find myself sort of, it's not conscious anymore. I surrender my need to look at what time it is or my calendar, and I get lost in the right type of way in the story, in the way you tell stories. And that's how I felt when I saw your stuff on HBO. And the nuance and the detail and the discipline and the all the stuff you probably hate that you have to do to stand out, because no one else is going to go to that level. And so you have to make a little set made out of clay and take 72 hours to make a 4-second clip. This is Van Nuys Tedesque. Mm. Is that how you see it? Like, tell me why, like, where did that come from? Why did you feel you needed to do it?
Oh man. So I'm doing this before COVID, or like right at the beginning of COVID, actually. Tom Sachs commissioned me to collaborate with him on writing his studio manual, which we've written 100 and something pages of it. And within it, there's a lot of like essays or like philosophy. It's all very, very, very practical stuff, like what, like the appropriate garbage bags to buy and stuff like that. But then there's also the equivalent of that, but like philosophically about that, this kind of business where you're making things from scratch and selling them. And we talk about the artist mindset, and the artist mindset is a belief that it can be done. It's not like a hope that can be done or a dream that it can be done. It's just, you know, you can do it, but do you really want to do it? Like you know, and I mean, what's okay. I have an example right here. All right. So this thing right here.
So you can't see it. So Van basically reaches off frame.
Yeah.
All right, what is this?
So this is a toy from the 70s and 80s, and it's, I think it came out in 1971, and it's called the Fisher Price Movie Viewer. It is not a ViewMaster. The ViewMaster is a thing with two eye holes, and you click it and you see 3D image. It is not that. It is called a movie viewer, and it has a little, it's a white, this one is black because I painted it, but it's a white device, and it has a little yellow cartridge that you slam into it, and then it's actually a movie projector. It's a little mini movie theater that you hold in your hand. And I got my first Super 8 camera in 2007, and I've always loved the idea of Super 8, and I love the reality of Super 8. The problem with Super 8 is the projecting of it. Setting up the projector is very difficult, and it's laborious, and nobody really wants to watch this stuff except you. So somehow I found Google. It wasn't YouTube. Some dad or something had busted open one of these cartridges and replaced it's 12 feet of Super 8 footage. So depending on the frame rate, that's about 2 or 3 minutes of footage. Some dad had like busted one open and put his home movie Super 8 footage in there. So I decided I was going to do that. And it took me not working 40 hours a week, but it took me 2 months to figure out how to make it so that it wouldn't jam, how to do the splice appropriately. One of the things is the film loop you make has to be basically exact. And this is an analog thing. There's no electricity. It's just a crank that you turn, and then a little box with a film loop that you have to make perfectly. And the film has to be going the right direction, and it has to be the correct side of the film. It could be, you get the whole thing put back together, you put it in the thing, it's upside down. You get the whole thing put back together, you put it in, it's right side up, but it plays in reverse when you crank the thing. So it's like a whole, and I've written my own directions. Anyway, it was like, okay, well, this is an easy idea. Some dad did this thing, and I'm sure his thing like maybe worked unless he's also, I'm not like, there are people who are really, if you're really smart, if you're really intelligent, it's an easier world for you. It just is, you know, I'm not world. It's not an easier world for you, but you're more likely to be successful in your endeavors because you can. But if you're a poor bastard who's just like persistent or like what's the non-euphemistic word? Stubborn, then you drag yourself through it. And there's a great film there's a documentary about Werner Herzog. Werner Herzog's a filmmaker who made a movie called Fitzcarraldo. And for the movie, he actually dragged a 1,000-ton ferry over a mountain in Peru. And he used a bulldozer, that's it. But it was all like primitive tools to do this thing. And it took him like from zero to done, it took him 10 years total to make this movie. And there's a documentary about that movie. And the title of the documentary is The Burden of Dreams. And it is a burden. If you're going to be someone who takes, it's astonishing to me that a human being can take a picture in their mind, which doesn't, that's fake. That is vapor. That is something that doesn't exist. It's not real. And then they can, with their hands and whatever, make the thing exist in the actual world. It's astonishing. Even writing your name on a piece of paper, it's astonishing. And as you click up and get a little bit better and a little bit better, you're always trying to do a little bit more. You're always trying to, and then all of a, at some point, for some reason, maybe not even conscious, it's okay. Now you're making a living doing this thing. So if you get sick, you need to have the money. It's going to be from this thing. And it's survival. I think, there's nothing creative. I'm not trying to be artistic. I'm just trying to get the job done with the resources I have. And like, I'm a stubborn person. I'm not good at working with people. And, so I'm trying to do like 10 people's jobs at once fast, you know, and that's where it's all improvisation. And luckily for me, I was born, you know, my generation is the last of the analog native humans. And so I have a certain degree of, you know, competence with, you know, fixing and making things. And that's basically what the channel is about.
So is the idea then that you're brutal to work with because however long it takes? And
no, it's because I'm kind of building the plane. I'm like always building the plane as I'm flying it. And I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you to do. And I don't understand what it is you don't understand about what we're doing. You know what I mean? Like, how far back do I have to go? Do I have to teach you how to read? Like, how fucking far back do I have to go to explain this thing to you? What isn't obvious about, you know, this thing? And then when I'm instructing, I'm trying to give you, okay, this is what's going to trip you up. This is what's going to trip you up. This is because I've been through so much stuff. I've had so many things go wrong.
And are they really wrong? Is it really wrong or is it really right? But it's just the first wrong you needed.
That's wrong. You spend all day making a thumbnail. And even though you've, you know, reminded the person you're working with that it's 2 megabytes.
I would say.
Maximum. And they give you the 4 megabyte one, you know.
So this.
It's wrong. You can't use it. YouTube won't accept it. And that whole photo shoot and all of the photoshopping and all of the. I mean, it's not hard to fix. It's a, you know. 10 minutes, not even maybe 1 minute to fix, but like you did it wrong and it's 2 megabytes and you know that. And what the fuck, you know, but you can't say that to a person who's like slaved away for you for free. You know?
You know? All right. This is a great segue into we're coming down the home stretch with Van Nystat. Ready? So one of the things I love that you have on your at Van Nystat Instagram right now is you have, it's so Van, although I don't think it takes you 12 hours to make these, but it's these little post-it notes, these yellow post-it notes. But of course, in Van, as only Van would do, and I'm sure you're going to give me all the adjectives and details because I'm almost doing it a disservice to just call it a typewriter. So what type of typewriter is it?
Oh, it's a Smith Corona. Actually, I don't even know if it's a Smith Corona. It's like an A.E. Smith and Corona company, 1936 Sterling flat top portable. It's like a fucking, I mean, it costs $100. That's how nice it is. It's like $100 one. That's like a $50,000 computer.
Do you still call the post-it note a post-it note?
Yeah, it's okay. Super sticky post-it note.
Okay, so he's got this 7-cent post-it note that you can get at any Target, and in this fancy.
Well, no, because you have to get the golden, and they sell the yellow ones at Target. The golden one you have to order. But
okay, so what are we looking here? A back order for a month? What are we? Is it Amazon?
Yeah, next day, Prime. God bless okay, Amazon.
Okay, yeah. So you have these like little, very Van-esque. I would call them motivational, poetic quips. And so I just want to like, we're just gonna do two of yours, and then. In the spirit of, you know what, I can't just give him his because he's already thought about that. I wrote two that I think are I think they could go on a gold, you know, prime post-it note, but I just want to get your take on them more than I don't need to see them on your channel. I just want to get your take on them. But let's start with one of yours. So you've got one, the fool who persists in his folly will become wise.
Isn't that such a fucking relief, man? Oh my God, I heard that. And I think some of these, some people don't understand. I think they think, I don't know what people think. It's very hard to convey how difficult it is to make a living from your creative endeavors, especially ones that are the just something of interest that maybe you're not necessarily great at. And that's from Alan Wise said that. And he, you know, he's like one of these gurus from the 70s, but it turns out he's like an alcoholic. He was always talking about all this like mindfulness and be present and all this shit. He was like a chain smoking diet of alcoholism. Alcoholics. I was like, okay, buddy, great. But he's quoting Blake. And I don't really know who that is, but I know that when John Lennon met Allen Ginsberg for the first time, Allen Ginsberg says, have you read Blake? And John Lennon said, never heard of him. But yeah, the fool who persists in his folly will become wise, because that for me is what my work has done to me. That's what my work has done for me. It has taught me, like, I've had to become the person who set out to do what I'm trying to do was not capable of doing the thing. So that I had to change. Tony Robbins talks about this. I had to change that person into a person who is capable of doing these things. And it's always the hardest, least skilled thing that you've got to work your ass off, and you're not getting around it. You say, oh, I'm just creative. I'm not good at business. Too bad. You're not exempt. No one is. And you might get a little fire in the beginning, but they're going to steal all your money. And that's what happens to those guys who get, I think that's what happens to those guys who get robbed, is that they just like got intoxicated by the creativity and the success of it, and they didn't keep their eyes on the prize. Okay, sorry, I'm so long-winded. Go ahead.
I know. First of all, there's no part of me that's, you know, we're not doing video. I'm not like wrap it up here. Like, I love that you're talking freely about it. I took the quote differently. I took the quote as like a peace of mind moment for you. Like, I took it as, like, go back to the guy you just said was the guy who's building this airplane and trying to fly it as it's in the air. And maybe you haven't told everybody that you're doing it, but you know it has to be done and you don't want this thing to crash, but you don't know how to do it, but you're going to figure it out, but you don't know when you're going to figure it out. And that's why you got to keep doing it until you figure it out. And then you figure it out and finally it becomes wise. So I looked at it that way, where it's like, okay, in order to make something special, right, with the resources that I have, and I've done it 100 times, but never like this. Here we go. Folly, 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 fuck. Shit. Shit. Didn't work. Did work a little bit. Can I do it better? I think it's just the creative process, which is what I loved about it. And it feels like you. It sounds like you. And there's joy. You can surrender some of the anxiety. You probably have a heart attack if you don't anyway, because you're just in the messy, knowing if you keep at this 18 weeks from now, it'll finally pay off. So that's what I liked about it. Now you have another one. You have another one that says, if you don't know your life's purpose, then your life's purpose is to find your life's purpose. And this is the one that just had me nodding and smiling. I like this one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're so blessed to be born in this country, you know, because the great idea of this country is like, these dudes were like, okay, we're going to make this thing so that people can arise to their highest potential. Potentially. Right. And this is the country that's kind of the idea of it, is like, this country will filter out the geniuses and make them rich and make them and give them a platform to make all of our lives better. This is the place that that's what this place was invented for. And so I don't know. It's just something I knew when I was setting out. I just wasn't good enough at anything at all to become a professional at it. There was nothing. And yet I had this very high ambition. Like I wanted to live well. I wanted to live in a very nice, beautiful place. I wanted to live well and I wanted to live big. And so I knew setting out that the hardest part was going to be figuring out what to do. That was, for me, that was what was going to be the hardest part, right? Eddie Murphy started at 15 years old. The earlier you start, the less time you have to put in for your big break because you're smarter and you're more malleable when you're younger. You start at 5 Mozart. You know, you're a virtuoso at 8 or 10. You're like 2 or 3 times faster than someone who starts at 25. My thing hadn't been invented yet. My thing, my purpose, the thing that I was going to do hadn't been invented until I was 25 years old. And that was the year that the iMac DV came out, which was a nonlinear digital editing platform that a regular person could afford. It was $1,300. And that came out in 2000. In 1999, the equivalent technology was $40,000. And college was $15,000 a year. So $40,000 is like 3 years of college. It's impossible. And if you wanted to get access to those machines and all of that technology, you had to go to NYU or USC. And who the hell can afford those places? So, you know, and I just knew that, like, finding it, finding the thing, and you don't find it. What you do is you go, okay, I'm going to be a writer. I want to be like Hunter Thompson. I want to live like that guy. And so, you know, you go down that road and it just doesn't feel right. And you persist and you're like, I don't know. I don't like it. And then maybe there's some distraction. There's a fork, something, you know, that this is all the stories, you know, Luke Skywalker runs into old Ben Kenobi and Luke Skywalker wants to be the thing, but you know, he's not going to get there the route he thinks he's going to get there by. And yeah, that's your life's mission. That's what you do. And you've got to do it young. Just find it. And maybe it's not your career. Maybe it's some other thing. Maybe it's not your career. It, you know, I don't know. It's just what your purpose is, I guess.
Well, to me, there's this leads into one of the two I wanted to share that I had written and I liked, and I'd love your honest take because I think the thinking is what's holding a lot of people back. So this is the first one. Whether you think you can or think you can't, you're thinking too much. Just start.
That's so great. That's great.
Right, like
so great.
Isn't that the Jedi has to go on the event? Like if you
never get out. It doesn't matter if you can't. You can't. But what the fuck difference does that make? You know what I'm saying? However, you can't quit before you started. If you're a paraplegic, you're never, ever, ever going to play in the NBA. You're just not. Don't be like, no. No. And then there's like, you know, there's a spectrum of that. There's a spectrum of that. And you have to know when to quit. Never give up. Like, you know, I did that film with Tom Sachs called Paradox Bullets. And Werner Herzog did the voiceover for it. And one of the bullets is never give up and know when to quit.
I love that. Well, I'm curious to hear if the second one resonates or if you're anti.
All right,
so and I shouldn't even say that because then it puts you in the mindset to be like, yeah, look for Kool-Aid the anti.
Well,
right. Yeah. I did that. So okay, the secret of success is no secret. Don't cut corners, commit to a cause, chop wood daily. Don't cut corners, commit to a cause, chop wood daily.
Do you really have to commit to a cause? Like what?
Well, isn't that the purpose part? Isn't that define your life's purpose? If you don't know your life's purpose. Well,
I guess I would ask, what is a cause? What define cause for me?
I think it's conscious. What is the conscious thing you're going after?
Okay. Sure.
That's what I meant. So
wait, I can be clear.
The secret of success. Chop wood.
Absolutely. Yes. Chop wood.
Chop wood daily. Right.
Yeah.
So don't cut corners.
Chop wood daily. Go ahead. So go ahead.
The secret of success is no secret. Mm-hmm. Don't cut corners. Commit to your cause. Chop wood daily.
Yeah. What's wrong with cutting corners?
Okay, there you go. So it's cutting corners, though. Like, I got to call Casey and he can make a phone call for me and I just saved myself like a year and a half.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, cutting corners is, okay. Having put in 20 years of filmmaking, okay, and making thousands of short films, I called my brother and he said, can you get me monetized without me having to meet all of the requirements that YouTube has? You have to have 40,000 subscribers and you have to have certain number of hours of your shit watched. I was monetized out the gate because Casey had connections at YouTube. And that's cutting a corner, baby. That's cutting millions of people in line.
Okay. But,
hey, you go start making films with Casey Neistat 20 years ago. Go ahead. And then I'll let you in. I'll open the door.
That's what I'm saying. Is it really cutting a corner? Is that really cutting a corner?
Yeah, that is cutting a corner. I didn't just I'm going to do it myself and like start from scratch with that particular endeavor.
All right. So take us home. So if I'm listening to this, I always like to say like, wow, if somebody has made it the 56 minutes that you and I have just been having an epic conversation, they're invested. You know, we are now beyond the little walk that someone had with their dog and we were in their ears, right? They're still listening to us.
We're in Rogan territory.
Right. Okay. Hey, a guy can dream.
The Rubicon.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. A guy can dream. So what do you want the lesson to be for people? What do you want them to take away? And you can decide, because I don't think it's for me to guide. You can decide from the life of Van Neistat or from this conversation on it. And I don't think one is actually easier than the other. But if you were going to take us out and take us home, how would you end this episode?
Well, I think you ever see these videos? It's like this viral video and it's like a 10-year-old. What would you say to a 9-year-old? And then an 11-year-old, what would you say to a 10-year-old? And it goes all the way up to like a 90-year-old. I think it might go decade by decade. So I think one of the things that it sucks to learn this, and you learn it, and I learned it, thank God, I learned it in my like mid-40s, but like life is really difficult for every single person, including Paris Hilton. Life is really, really, really hard. And if you're born in America, probably more than any other place, you get to choose your misery. You get to choose, to some extent, you get to choose the cross to bear. You get to choose your suffering. And it doesn't matter what you choose. You are going to suffer and it is going to be unbelievably difficult. You're barely going to be able to do whatever you do, including if you want to do nothing and be homeless. That is a fucking hard, hard job because you're going to have to figure out how to wash your clothes or not wash them or sleep and cops and crime and security and all of that stuff. Whatever you choose, it's that. So don't be a cheapskate. Like choose something worthy, you know? But the big thing is like, it's okay. It's life is miserable. Life kills everyone.
And there is the lesson. And it kind of gives like you a little bit of like you can breathe when you say it that way. It's going to be okay. And it's difficult. I mean, look, your last name is
going to be miserable. You know, it's going to be okay, but it's also going to be miserable. It's gonna
he's saying
be
this
really hard.
He's saying this with a huge smile on his face, which I love. That's life. But isn't that what you do?
Yeah, but it's a surprise because that's not what the culture, that's not what this culture tells you. This culture, the American like message is that if you do some, if you do XYZ correctly, you've won, it's over, you've made it. And it's just, that is not, it's a grind. It is a grind. And you get reprieve every once in a while. You know what, corporate America gives you 2 weeks vacation, right? So that's 4%. That's about right. 4% of your life is not a grind.
You get 4%.
I get less. I haven't had a vacation. My psychiatrist was like, can you do a week off every 12 weeks? And I'm like, no. He's like, when's the last time you had a vacation? And I was just like, you know, and the answer is 2014, 2015. I've never been paid for a vacation. I've never had a paid vacation my whole life. Never.
But on the flip, you're not working for some corporate guy that doesn't get you, where it's 100 hours.
I don't have the conveniences of working for, you know, a corporation where they have an HR department and they have an IT department and they have a healthcare program, right? And like, if my kid's sick, I have a personal day and I cannot go in and I, you know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, yeah, I chose this. This is the misery I chose. The person who chose that corporate job chose the misery of sitting in a job they hate every day. And I'm not saying mine's better. I'm not saying mine's better at all. No, no way. It's not.
It just is.
It's just, that's the one, this, like he says, you know, I didn't ask who gave the order because it was just business. This is the life we've chosen. It's the Godfather too, man.
So I have bad news and good news. Which one, yeah. What do you want as we end the show? What do you want first?
Give me the bad news first.
The bad news is I cannot pay you to come see me. The good news is there will be a burger waiting for you as usual in San Diego. Please come. Bring the family. I love you. I root for you. And as always, I go back, by the way, to like the first piece of commentary we ever talked about was your last name and no one could pronounce it, right? No one knew how to spell it, or they could spell it, they couldn't pronounce it. It was Nice Tat. I'm like, hey, why don't you do a video? Nice Tat. Remember this?
Yes. It's in Casey's video that he made about me when I launched my channel.
Oh, it's in there?
Like millions of people have seen it. Yeah, I made a video for when Hillary Clinton mispronounced our name in front of like 2,000 people.
All right, can you give me that link? I'm going to add that link into the podcast. And I don't think
Casey's video.
Well, I don't think it's like, I don't want to do it if it's going to come off as like promoting me. But I remember like talking to you about, hey, you should do a video about Nice Tat, like just so people could understand how to pronounce it. So you came into the world already with a difficulty, right? No one knew how to fucking say your last name. Hold on, Adam Baker, take that part out. No one knew how to say your damn last name. Adam Baker helps me produce these. So, and then you made that video and it's like, oh, that's how you say it. Nice Tat. Nice Tat. How did you do it? What was it? Was it a, what was the video?
Oh, it was like, it was a whole complicated thing, but it was like nice, like rice or ice. And then if someone got a tattoo that you like, it would be a nice tattoo, a nice tat.
Nice
something
tat.
Like, yeah, something like that. Nice.
Well, I love you, brother.
Upload that to my, I think, just upload it. Put it on YouTube.
I'll always root for you. Come visit for real. Randy and I would love to see you. And we're now been married for over a decade. Wow. So can you believe it? You were there, you and yeah. Neve, the dance party. And now here we are.
I believe it. Y'all are wonderful people.
Oh, thanks, brother. Be good. Lots of love.
Brother, thank you. I love this. This is great. Take care.